Welcome to HealthCetera. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. Dying. It's something we're all going to do eventually. But talking about how we want to die is not something we as a society are comfortable doing. Is it better to try everything to prolong life, regardless of the quality of that life? Or do we sometimes need to face the inevitable and make it as good an experience as possible for both the person and their family? Today on HealthCetera, we're going to continue our ongoing conversations about how we die. Some of these conversations get at how we and our family and friends feel about dying and caring for someone who is dying. Some focus on what the healthcare system does or does not do to support people having choices in dying and in a dignified, comfortable death. And sometimes we need to talk about the legal aspects of our right to die. Today, we're going to talk with David Levin, Executive Director of End of Life Choices New York, an organization that has filed a lawsuit to get New York State to permit aid in dying. But first, we'll hear from filmmakers Carolyn Jones and Lisa Frank, who want to change the conversation about death and dying. They're currently filming a new documentary called Dying in America, looking at this issue through the eyes of nurses, those who deal with life and death struggles daily. Some are good struggles, some are not. All are important. Jones and Frank recently spoke with co-producer Liz Siegert about their passion for this topic and why everyone needs to pay attention to this issue.
This is Liz Siegert. I'm here with Carolyn Jones and Lisa Frank, director and producer of Dying in America, a new documentary that focuses on hospice and palliative care and the role that nurses have to play in that process. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rather than me trying to describe what this documentary is about, why don't I let you do it?
Sure. Well, Lisa and I worked together on a project called The American Nurse, and we have been working with nurses across the country for the last 4 years. And what we discovered and what the topic that rose to the surface for us was that we're not dying very well in this country, and we spend an awful lot of money not dying very well. And the stories that the nurses told us led us into this place of really wanting to do a new documentary that explores the different ways that people are dying in America, and successful and some less successful, but focusing on the nurses and the role that nurses play at the end of life.
Lisa, how did you get involved in producing this?
Well, I've been working with Carolyn for a long time now, probably about 7 or 8 years, and she dragged me into it. But I was really excited to get to work on the American Nurse Project. I had no background dealing with nurses, so it was a brand new introduction for me, really, to anything healthcare related in terms of the work that we were doing. So I actually really appreciated having that fresh perspective because I got to learn from ground zero what nursing is all about and what nurses do. And I had no idea. And I didn't know all the education that went into it. I didn't know the scope of nursing practice, the different kinds of nursing specialties. There were really so many things that I think we were learning constantly. And as Carolyn said, you know, early on we met a hospice nurse in Florida who said to us, Americans think that death is optional. And we, which was a great line, first of all, but we really thought about that and said that that's right. You know, as a culture, we don't like to talk about it. We don't like to think about it, and we're not doing it well. And nurses see us in those moments and have so much to teach us. So I think in terms of how we dove into it, as Carolyn said, it all started with the nurses and realizing that this is a topic we need to focus on.
Now, you went around and spoke to nurses in hospitals, in hospice organizations, and nurses that do home care and other kinds of care. Did you find a difference in their attitude, whether they were in an institution or whether they were caring for somebody at home?
You know, not really. I mean, I found there were a lot of consistencies with the nurses that were dealing with end-of-life issues. It was kind of like there are nurses that do function on this level, and then there are the nurses that don't want to touch it. And that was that surprised me a little bit. But it's kind of like a threshold that they get to and get over to be able to work with people. I think, you know, our whole sensibility is about fixing people, getting them better to get back out there. And so many of the nurses I met weren't comfortable with the idea of working with people that were never going to get better. But so I found them very similar in terms of the passion that they have for working with people at the end of life. Nurses use the word privilege so much. It's such a privilege to be with people at this stage of their lives, that they honor that time and how wonderful it is to spend time with the family. So they use different words, these nurses that are dealing with end of life, than the rest of the nurses that I've met.
I agree with that. I think the one difference would be the nurses working in home care, I think in some cases, had more autonomy and felt more empowered, you could say, really, because they, you know, in the American Nurse Project, we had Jason in the Appalachian Mountains going into people's homes where he's the only healthcare provider that they're going to see. And he's by himself with his little bag of supplies. So he really was there. He was the doctor. You know, there wasn't this sense of hierarchy and needing to go back and report to his medical team and get, you know, he was really there with the family doing whatever they needed. So I do think that that was a different point of view. And in terms of the home care nurses we've met here in New York and throughout the country for this project, to some extent, wouldn't you say, Carolyn, that that was true?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I was thinking of when you were saying that was, you know, when we were working on the American Nurse Project, we heard a lot about, you know, nurses kind of butting heads with doctors and getting to this place of a moral dilemma. The doctor's prescribing something or suggesting an operation or, you know, saying, let's have another round of chemo, and I don't agree with that. I don't think it's what the patient would have wanted. In fact, that's one of the things that has spurred us on to want to do this project is so many of those, I'm really sort of interested in what that means for a nurse to have a moral dilemma about the work that they're doing. So the one thing that's kind of different about the nurses working at end of life is a lot of that dissipates when you're not trying to fix someone. So the doctors that are at end of life care have a different role to play too. No one's trying to fix at that point. Everyone's trying to do comfort care. So it's a whole, I find that the whole world of end-of-life care, the nurses have more autonomy, no matter where they are, because there isn't this overwhelming need to fix somebody, but just to make them more comfortable.
One of the nurses that I heard on the clips yesterday talked about how difficult it is getting, not necessarily the patient, but the families, to accept the inevitable. Can you talk a little bit about those kind of dilemmas?
Sure, man. Holy smokes. It's the families at the end of the day that are difficult. We've heard stories that would curl your hair, actually. The nurses are very focused on doing what the patient wants, but I don't think the family is. It's one of the things that it really made me want to do this project. I want our film and our website and our project to direct the attention back to the patient. This is about the patient's time. And I think very often, either the guilt of family members who haven't resolved issues that they need to resolve, or religious feelings that the family members might have that are different than the patient's feelings, there are all these things that come into the room and influence this person in the bed. Our whole sensibility of keep fighting Uncle Jimmy and, you know, don't give up. And it's like John Wayne attitude of getting on the horse and getting out there and fighting this thing until the bitter end. Well, honestly, we need to be able to ask the patient, what do they want? And there is a moment that patients get to when they're tired of fighting. That's it. They're finished. And one of my biggest goals for what we're doing is to get everybody to be able to say, oh, they're at that moment. Let's embrace that and let's encourage them to follow whatever their wishes are instead of guilting them out to feel crummy about giving up. You know, we have all this language that ends up in, it even ends up in obituaries. Well, you know, Jane fought the good fight until the very end. You know, honestly, it's time for us just to support those patients, and whenever they reach a moment when they've had enough, that we're able to help guide them.
And this was actually one of the biggest misconceptions we had going into the project, I think, that was blown away not only by the nurses, but the one other interview we have on the website that's not with a nurse is with Dr. Kenneth Prager. He's the chair of the Medical Ethics Committee at Columbia. And we went in to his interview saying, well, when you have these ethics committee meetings about a specific case or patient, you know, isn't it the doctor that wants to do XYZ interventions and then the patient family doesn't want? He said, no, 90% of the time, it's the family members. The doctor's ready to say, you know, this is what I recommend. And the family members say, no, we want to do, quote, everything. So that kind of surprised us, I have to say.
Yeah, no, I think a couple things happened with Dr. Prager that were really interesting turning points for us. I came into this a year ago thinking we have a responsibility as the public to assume responsibility over our own end of life. It's a different time. And Dr. Prager talked about how as recent as 30 or 40 years ago, before we had such extensive ICUs, we had no ethics committees at hospitals because we didn't need them. If you were sick enough, you went into the hospital and you either died or you got better, but we didn't prolong the dying process as long as we do now. So it is a very confusing time for people. And I think each one of us individually needs to start to think about what do we want? How do we own this? And I think it should empower us. It should make us feel as though we have some kind of handle on it. Because this, Dr. Prager talks so eloquently about this, but this idea of doing everything 30 or 40 years ago had very different meaning than it has now. Doing everything, that now you can keep a body alive for a long, long time. Do we really want that? Should we? Is it right? I mean, one of the other things that struck me about Dr. Prager was I went into that interview, and it's such an interesting process to go through this, but I went into that interview thinking, we do too much. You know, we need to let people stop the treatment when they want to. And I think I was hoping with this film that we would encourage people to get there faster. And he was like, not so fast with that. The will to live is such a powerful and amazing thing that we have to respect that too. And that it sort of recentered me to realize that really what is important is to listen to the patient. What does the patient want? And if the patient wants to do everything and keep fighting, well, so be it. That is the will to live coming through. But if the patient's ready to call it a day, we must get to a point as a society where we can support that.
Why do you think we have such a problem as a society talking about death and dying? It's, we hear, you know, death panels and, oh, you know, we'll do everything we can to keep you going. There are people who are 95 that are alive, but, you know, you wonder about their quality of life. What is it with our society? It seems to be much more openly discussed in other countries.
I mean, personally, I think that we're so youth-oriented and we're so in the now, in the moment, we're so Botoxed and we're so into staying young forever. I mean, what is it now? 70 is the new 40? I don't know. It's getting ridiculous. And we're a society that doesn't respect our elders. We don't stay together as a family unit anymore. We used to, but it's a big country. And our spirit of being American, I think, and I don't mean this in a detrimental way, but our spirit is to get out there and like forge new territories and conquer new conquests, right? The days of growing up and having your grandparents next door and your great-grandparents down the road, they're so long gone for us. And it's true in many other countries, this is still very, very valued. Well, in our country, we tend to kind of ship our elderly off to other parts of sunny parts of our country and go visit them Easter, Christmas, and maybe a Sunday or two. And we don't really value the whole passage of time and the intellect and wisdom that comes with age. These are things that we don't speak positively about. So I think as soon as you lose that ability to honor the elderly, you start pushing death away. And we don't like anything that's too, you know, too negative or talks about the end of life.
We also don't have a really good policy in this country for long-term care, for helping people through the palliative and end-of-life process. It's pretty much, you know, go out and find it on your own. What do we need to do as a country to help make this process more visible and more acceptable?
Well, part of the solution from what we understand from the nurses is ultimately going to come down to money. It comes down to reimbursements. So we aren't necessarily experts at this at all, but my understanding is that if we, you know, the more that Medicare, now that Medicare is saying that they will reimburse, you know, for practitioners to have those end of life conversations with patients, that could be a really good step in the right direction. And the more that, you know, insurance companies are willing to do that kind of thing, I think that we start to move in a good direction. But we also have some really good ideas from nurses we've talked to and other nurse experts where the nurse can play a really important role in palliative care, where they really can be the one to spearhead those conversations with patients and families. And we aren't utilizing them enough as a resource, especially in hospitals where, you know, they could really take over that role.
I think one of the things that we've heard about is that very often the palliative care department is like six beds in the corner of a hospital somewhere, and it's funded by contributions. It's not even in the way the hospital is set up financially. So, and then you have these markers. I guess you can bring in palliative care of the last 2 days of someone's life, or if someone's designated as stage four cancer. But if you moved that all forward and you got palliative care in there much, much sooner and normalized the conversation about death, I mean, it's scary right now because you see a palliative care nurse coming, you know the end is right around the corner if the hospital's sending that nurse in. So if when you were diagnosed with cancer, you were introduced to the concept of palliative care, it would make it so much better. So I think we just have to, we're moving in the right direction, but we have to push all that way forward.
Let's switch gears for a second and talk about the production aspects. How did you find these nurses?
So over the last year, we had a grant from the Jonas Center, who sponsored us to interview 50 nurses dealing with end of life in different parts of the country and in different environments. So we spent the last year going across the country and meeting these nurses. And we chose them based on a whole lot of things. But actually, Lisa, I'll let you talk a little bit about how we landed with the nurses that we found.
Well, a couple of places we went back to from the American Nurse Project. So we had really loved working with Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore and Children's National in D.C. And so the nurses we had met there for American Nurse, of course, weren't specifically focused on end of life. But we wanted to go back and get those two perspectives again. So this time around at Johns Hopkins, though, we still said, let's go to the emergency department. Because even though that's not what you think of as palliative care, you know, they have a lot of patients dying there on a daily basis, and let's understand what that looks like. At Children's National, we thought it was really critical to talk about what happens when children die. It's an untimely death. It's really difficult to deal with. If we can't even deal with talking about dying at the age of 95, you know, how can we get our country to talk about children who are dying? So all of those things, we wanted to kind of represent some different perspectives. We wanted to have hospice, we wanted to have home care, we wanted to have a nursing home setting. In Oregon, we wanted to touch upon the death with dignity law, so we wanted to meet a couple of nurses, one who's a volunteer with Compassion and Choices out there, another one who is spending time not dealing with death and dignity, but she's educating groups of nurses, groups of senior citizens in the church community about, you know, choices that they have. So I think we just wanted to show, like we did with American Nurse Project, as much of the diversity and the sort of breadth of, you know, the kinds of nurses that are out there dealing with these issues.
I mean, I think one thing we've discovered is nurses make incredible storytellers. I don't know whether it's because they sit at the bedside so much or they're dealing with real issues every day, but they're able to cut to the quick so fast and be really kind of engaged in these topics in a way that I've been interviewing people all my life for books or films or whatever the project is. I've never encountered a group of people that were so open and could deliver information so brilliantly. And that kind of storytelling is what I think we as patients need when this time comes in our lives and when we're trying to decide whether to do that next round of chemo for ourselves or our loved ones, right? So having a nurse tell us a story or having a nurse, you know, explain what the doctor said, what it really meant, what the doctor said, I think is a wonderful thing. I mean, when Lisa was mentioning Children's National, and, you know, I'll go to a hospital like that and meet nurses who are dealing with children at the end of life. And, you know, you hear a story from a nurse, one in particular I'm thinking of, that told me a story about being with the parents after the child had just died and washing the body of the child and how healing that was, not just for the parents, but also for the nurses who'd cared for the child. Well, this is such a beautiful thing. And anything that can be that beautiful and that healing is something we want to shine a light on. I mean, also, the nurses talked about how productive it was for those parents to get involved in giving organs away of their loved ones to help someone else, how healing that was and made it feel like the, you know, the child's life was you know, doing some good. And those are the kinds of things. There's this richness, there's this beauty at the end of life that I'm so wanting to dig into and show that it isn't this, it's always sad, but it isn't always so awful. There's great, great beauty at the end of life when we appreciate life so very much, and that's what we want to show.
You have clips up on the website now, and we'll give that URL in a minute. What is the next phase? When will it become a full-fledged film?
So the clips that are on the website are not part of the film project. That's all of our research, all of our conversations. We wanted to create a website that both patients and family members could go to, and a place where you could like click on a word like morphine and find out what it's like, you know, for patients to be dealing with these different drugs, or click on a word like guilt and see what nurses have to say about family members that are feeling guilty. So we wanted to, you know, educate a lot with that website. The film has been born out of that year of research, and we're very excited that both the Jonas Center and the American Nurse Foundation have gotten behind our project to fund moving forward with the documentary film. And, you know, a film is kind of a flexible thing because we haven't really dug in yet, but we did start shooting a few days at Calvary Hospital and followed a nurse there, which was an extraordinarily beautiful experience. And we are going back to Johns Hopkins, where, as Lisa mentioned, we'll be focused on the emergency department there and Children's National. And then we'll cover home health probably in Oregon. So it's probably a year away before we're finished with a finished film, but I don't think much longer than that.
Will it be released in theaters again, or will it be shown on HBO? How do you plan to distribute?
At the moment, and again, before the film is finished, it's always kind of hard to know what the right audience is, but I'm very, very focused on the theater-going public. I would really like to have this film in theaters once again. I think that that's an unusual experience to be with other people in this. I love having the most intimate thing in the world up on a big screen that you're sitting with other people. I think it's a completely different experience than sitting in your living room and watching something. So we're very focused on having a theatrical release. Now, whether or not the American public will pay $15 to go see a film about end of life, I have no idea. But I do think that this film is going to be enlightening and beautiful and very focused on what's worthy of us cherishing in life.
What about the media? How have we done as a group to bring attention to this issue? We report on candidates that may come out against so-called death panels or funding these physician conversations, but have we done these topic justice, or is it underreported? What would you like to see us do differently?
I think it's getting better. And first of all, you're doing great. So the fact that we're sitting here having this conversation now pretty much, I think, explains it. But you know, the New York Times now has their whole section called The End, right, on their website. So I think that more and more we're seeing this topic being reported on, and that's great. And I think that we're starting to see a bit of a zeitgeist in terms of also, I'm not sure if it's reached, Joe public yet in terms of wanting to talk about it, but I do think that a certain segment of the public is starting to want to have these conversations as baby boomers are, approaching needing to have these conversations. So we feel pretty optimistic about the media, and we're actually hoping that we're going to catch this wave of interest with this project so that we can, reach as broad an audience as possible.
You know, honestly, 3 years ago when we were starting the American Nurse film, I wanted that film to be about the end of life, but I couldn't get arrested with that. I mean, honestly, nobody wanted to talk about it. So I feel...
We snuck it in, though, anyway.
We did sneak it in a bit, yeah. But really, for us to be able to speak very openly about this now and have that be a conversation that we can have, I thank the media for that. Because it's true what Lisa said. You've got baby boomers all over this country dealing with aging parents that have been kept alive in many cases longer than they ever imagined or even wanted. Quality of life is waning, and we've just got, the elderly that we don't know what to do with. It's like a morphine fest out there. No one knows kind of how to best deal with it. So whatever we can do to illuminate how it can be and what it should be and what's possible, I think is great. So I think that any opportunity the media has to talk about the more positive aspects, the kind of battle between the parties right now and how we feel about what's getting funded and what's not getting funded, I wish we could unpoliticize this. We are all going to be dealing with this, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, and we want our loved ones not to suffer, and we need to talk about it and get it untied from politics.
Where can people go to find out more information and view some of the fascinating and very heartwarming clips that you have?
Dyinginamerica.org. That is our website, and I don't know if that will be the title of the film. It's our working title right now, but our website is up and running, and honestly, there are so many wonderful nurses there telling so many great stories and illuminating all kinds of subjects about end of life, so we hope people will go to that.
And you can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and we're rolling out a new video every couple of days on Facebook and Twitter, and so those are getting shared on social media, so we hope that people will keep following us that way as well.
Great. Carolyn Jones, Lisa Frank, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Health Cetera producer Liz Siegert opening today's program on Dying in America. I'm Diana Mason, one of the other producers of Health Cetera, that's brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at www.healthmediapolicy.com. That's healthmediapolicy.com. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City and live streaming at WBAI.org. For the second part of today's program, we're going to talk about efforts to legalize aid in dying in New York State. The organization leading this effort is End of Life Choices of New York, and I'm pleased to have David Levin, Executive Director of the organization, as my guest to talk about this initiative. David, welcome back to Health Cetera, although it was Health Styles when you came on before. Welcome.
It was, Diana. Thank you. It's very nice to be back with you.
Good to have you. Well, first, let's talk about what we mean by aid in dying.
Aid in dying is the process by which a mentally competent, terminally ill patient with 6 months or less to live obtains a prescription of medicines which the patient can take and, in fact, must take him or herself in order to end his or her suffering and achieve a peaceful death.
And how does this differ from assisted suicide?
We don't think it is a suicide at all. In fact, it's been a misnomer for many years, and now, increasingly, there are both organizations that reject the term assisted suicide because it is prejudicial, but also because it's really not a suicide. So the American Public Health Association, the American Medical Women's Association, the American Medical Students Association, the American College of Legal Medicine, and also the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine, which has a neutral position on the issue of aid in dying, takes a position which rejects the term assisted suicide. Now, why isn't it a suicide? Well, it's not a question of whether the patient is going to die, but how the patient is going to die. And patients who consume life-ending medicines at the very end of their lives are really not suicidal. They want to continue to live. So there are stark differences between suicides and aid in dying. Suicides are committed by those who could continue to live, but choose not to. They're done in isolation, often impulsively, and often violently. And they're really tragic. To the contrary, aid in dying is available only to people who are terminally ill, who will soon die. The process takes ordinarily at least several weeks. It occurs almost always after consultation with and support of family members. And, of course, there is a necessary consultation with physicians. And the process is actually empowering. So the term assisted suicide really is not an appropriate term for this process that we now characterize as aid in dying.
So it's I think, a lesson to all of us to be conscious of the language that we're using, and to, when you hear somebody talk about assisted suicide, to really correct them and try to differentiate and say this is aid in dying, and we need to really be careful of our language. Now
I think that's right, and it's also important because when people think about the issue and what actually happens, if the term assisted suicide is used, and people often say, well, that's bad. People shouldn't be committing suicide. Mm. And so it is important to use correct language. Language does matter.
Now, Oregon and California are two states that have legalized aid in dying, although I believe Oregon still calls it assisted suicide.
No, they don't,
oh,
actually.
Good.
In fact, in the law itself, the term assisted suicide, again, is rejected. And the person's death is considered to be, and on the death certificate, the person's, what the underlying illness was. So the act itself is called the Death with Dignity Act. Mm. But you're right, actually that was changed some years ago because there was a time when even under the Oregon law it was being characterized as assisted suicide, but Oregon's health department learned its lesson, I think, some 7 or 8 years ago. So you're right, there was that terminology used at the beginning, but it has changed. In California, the term has been rejected. And in fact, in every law which has been enacted or passed by ballot initiative, and their ballot initiatives were passed in Oregon and Washington, a law in Vermont, and in California, every state has rejected the term assisted suicide and very plainly states that the act that is done by the patient in taking the medications is not to be construed as a suicide or assisted suicide or euthanasia or mercy killing or anything like that. And the same is true of bills that are pending in a number of state legislatures, including in New York.
So let's, before we get into New York, let me ask you, well, let's go to New York. So in New York, we don't have any aid in dying legislation. We don't have a law authorizing aid in dying. Who are the opponents to this? Because you've tried, and you're continuing to try, and we'll talk about those efforts, but who opposes this?
Well, we don't have a specific law which authorizes, but actually there's a lawsuit which is pending, which we can also talk about, which is asserting that under the existing statute, which bans suicide, aid in dying does not fall within the confines of that statute, and so therefore aid in dying should be permissible. And in fact, it might be, and it will hopefully get a declaratory declaration from the court that it is ultimately. But the opponents of aid in dying are both the Catholic Church and the New York Catholic Conference, which recently submitted an amicus brief in opposition to our appellate brief in the appellate division after our case had been dismissed by the lower court. Some disability rights organizations, some religious affiliations. So it's a variety of people, and yet the vast majority of citizens, including, for example, Catholics, close to 75% in a poll that was conducted in September, actually support aid in dying. The American Medical Association has been an opponent for many years, and while their position has not changed, there has been a substantial change in the thinking of doctors across the country. So the most recent poll that was conducted in December of 2014 revealed that an overwhelming plurality of doctors now support aid in dying, 54% to 31%.
So we're making progress, we're making headway, but you are the end of life Choices New York has filed a lawsuit to establish aid in dying in New York. It's the Myers versus Snyderman case. Tell us about this lawsuit and the judge's action and what your plans are next.
All right, the lawsuit was initiated in February of last year by three patients, one of whom had cancer, one had AIDS and AIDS-related diseases, and he actually died just this morning, and one who has ALS, as well as three of whom were the physicians who brought the case that went to the United States Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court held that under the federal Constitution, there was no constitutional right either under the Due Process or Equal Protection Clauses of the federal Constitution. And those doctors are somewhat well-known, certainly Dr. Timothy Quill, who was until recently the head of palliative care at the University of Rochester Medical Center. He's still there working in the palliative care department. Dr. Samuel Cladsbrun, who runs Four Winds Hospitals in New York State, is a well-known psychiatrist. And Dr. Howard Grossman, who is an HIV-AIDS doctor, and a highly respected doctor in that field, along with Dr. Charles Thornton, who specializes in ALS at the University of Rochester Medical Center.
And we might say ALS is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, that is Lou Gehrig's disease, where
yes.
You're essentially paralyzed.
And ultimately, you have no movement if you decide to continue to live under those circumstances, even if you continue to have cognitive functioning. And the woman who is the plaintiff, actually, who has ALS, is now pretty much confined to bed and has very little movement, with the exception of her eyes, and communicates that way and can use a computer that way. But she is quite unhappy with her current life circumstances, understandably. And at some point, were aid in dying legal in New York, she might very well want to access it, but she cannot do so now because doctors, understandably too, are fearful and will not take a risk of prescribing life-ending medicines for their patients despite their terrible suffering, for a risk of prosecution. So the lawsuit was brought in February on a motion to dismiss by the Attorney General against whom it was brought. And I should mention that the claims that were in the complaint were only state claims, no federal claims. So there are two state constitutional claims asserting that under either the Due Process or Equal Protection Clauses of the state constitution that people have a right to access medicines which they can take themselves to end their lives, and that doctors should not be and cannot be prosecuted for engaging in the process of prescribing the medications. Or that, as an alternative assertion that we make in the complaint that under the existing statute, which does ban assisting a suicide, that aid in dying does not fall within the confines of that statute. So the motion to dismiss by the Attorney General was granted by the trial court without ever there being an evidentiary hearing, with no testimony ever being taken, with no oral arguments even in her courtroom. And we believe that she erred in dismissing the case because we believe that the trial court ignored the complaint's factual allegations and erroneously dismissed our claim for declaratory relief concerning the meaning of the assisted suicide statute, as well as on the issues of due process and equal protection, which she did not really address, simply pretty much relying on the Supreme Court cases, which held that there was no federal constitutional right. And I should mention that New York state courts have, on occasion, granted broader rights to its citizens under the same or very similar provisions of the New York state constitution compared to the federal constitution. So we are hopeful that ultimately, if this case goes back to the trial court, that we will prevail there after, we hope, what will be an evidentiary hearing, and then we will prevail ultimately in the highest state court, which is in New York called the New York Court of Appeals. Most states, it's of course called the state Supreme Court, where we are hoping the court will recognize a broader right and a fundamental right to access aid in dying that exists for its citizens who are terminally ill and mentally competent.
Any idea of why Schneiderman filed the motion to dismiss the lawsuit?
I think that the state really has an obligation to defend against constitutional assertions which have not previously been recognized in the state. So it's not surprising at all that the Attorney General would defend. And we weren't, frankly, surprised by the lower court's decision, although we did not think it was a good decision. We did think that there was a good chance that the lower court would initially dismiss the case. So we are looking forward to our argument in the Appellate Division First Department, which is now scheduled for February 3rd at 2 o'clock. And the court is open to the public. We don't know exactly what time the case will be argued. There are a number of other cases which are listed before our case. We're number 8, and the arguments usually go 20 minutes to a half hour or so. But we are wonderful lawyers representing us. Lawyers from the Debevoise and Plimpton Law Firm, which is handling the case pro bono, and Catherine Tucker, who's a leading litigator in the end-of-life field, who has been involved with end-of-life issues and cases since the beginning and was involved in the U.S. Supreme Court cases in 1997.
And so if listeners wanted to provide some kind of support for your position on this appeal, obviously they could show up in court and just be witness to what goes on. Where is that court?
The court is on Madison Avenue between 25th and 26th Streets, I think.
In Manhattan.
In Manhattan, yes.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything else that people could do?
Well, people could certainly contact us to indicate their support. They can send me an email. They can go onto our website if they want to support the case or the legislation, which we can talk some more about as well.
And give us your website.
I can be reached, if I may give you my email address.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
At david@endoflifechoicesny.org.
One more time?
david@endoflifechoicesny.org.
Great. And your website?
www.endoflifechoicesny.org. www.aidanddying.org.
Great. And let me just remind listeners, I'm talking with David Levin, who is the Executive Director of the End of Life Choices New York organization. And we're talking about Aid in Dying in New York and efforts to really demonstrate that we are a progressive state the way we think we are when we're trailing California and Oregon on this issue. So tell us about some of the other strategies that you're using to try to get New Yorkers the right to aid in dying.
Well, we are proceeding with legislation that we initiated in the New York State Legislature, and we have excellent sponsors. We have majority sponsors in both houses. That means a Democrat in the Assembly, Assemblywoman Amy Paulin, who is a highly respected legislator, and a Senator John Bonachick in the Senate, who's a Republican, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee. So we have excellent sponsors, and we're going to be moving the bill forward as much as we can during the course of this year. And we feel that we have the arguments on our side just based on the experience of what has transpired in Oregon over some 18 years now, when the law there has worked just as intended. And there really aren't, in my view, any responsible arguments against aid in dying that can now be raised, as opposed to 20 years ago, when certainly legitimate concerns were asserted concerning the potential of vulnerable populations being disproportionately impacted, such as people with disabilities, poor people, people without insurance, people of color, the elderly, and so forth. And yet, a study that was reported in the Journal of Medical Ethics in 2007 dispelled any concern, showing that there was just no disproportionate impact on any of those populations. And in fact, the law has been used primarily by well-educated people, almost all of whom have health insurance. And so no real disproportionate impact, no problems really whatsoever in terms of how the law has been implemented and functioned over 18 years now in Oregon. So that, and then that some people will understandably say, well, if we just gave people better palliative care, if we just got them into hospice, that should be sufficient. And to a large extent, of course, that is true. It is sufficient for most people. Very few people actually take these medicines, about less than 1 in 300. But in Oregon, over 90% of those who ultimately die by aid in dying are actually in hospice getting the gold standard of end-of-life care. So you just can't make the argument that all we need to do is provide better palliative care or get people into hospice. And the fact is that we know not all suffering can be controlled, and that's why people have a right to end their suffering and their lives by other means, such as by having life-sustaining treatment withdrawn or never started, by palliative sedation, and that's palliative sedation being provided to people who have symptoms which can't legitimately be controlled by any reasonable means, usually pain, where people are sedated to unconsciousness, generally speaking, until they die, and life-sustaining treatments that they might be on are usually withdrawn. And so we know that, and then people die within 10 to 14 days. Well, for some people, palliative sedation might not be the best option. They might decide, well, instead of going through this two-week period that I might have to go through before I die, why can't I just be able to take these medicines, which will end my life quickly, where I can say goodbye to my family members and loved ones and have a relatively quick and efficient peaceful death.
So let me just ask you a question about the medicines. So knowing that you can get all kinds of medications online without a prescription, is the protocol for this online? Is it available? Is it how do people know what the protocol is?
Well, doctors in Oregon, certainly where it's the law, where aid in dying is legal, as well as in Washington and Vermont, Montana, know what the protocol or protocols are, because there's more than one. And there has to be a mix of medicines People might be able to get the information online. There is a book, which I don't know how up-to-date it is where people can get the information. But it's so much better to be able to do this above ground and legally. And I should say, by the way, this process is going on underground, illegally, unregulated. Mm-hmm. And it really needs to be brought above ground, made legal, and appropriately regulated. Mm-hmm. So, and doctors should always be involved in the process. So this is not something we would recommend to individuals to do on their own, but we would recommend that they contact if they are thinking about the end of their lives and thinking they are suffering and may want to possibly hasten their deaths by some means. And one other means that I didn't mention was voluntarily stopping mm-hmm. eating and drinking, which is another, generally speaking, peaceful, dignified way of dying but it does take, again, usually about 10 days to 2 weeks, but people mm-hmm. might call our counseling service. Mm-hmm. Judith Schwartz is a PhD-trained nurse. Mm-hmm. She provides excellent counseling to people and can guide them through the process to a certain extent at least. And it is worth giving her a call or sending her an email.
And she is fabulous. I can vouch for her. I had a nurse colleague who was dying, and I asked Judith to come and talk with her because she didn't want to prolong her life and was worried about what the end might be like. And it was just a really thoughtful, informative discussion. It wasn't Judith just telling her things. It was Judith listening to my friend and what was important to her and answering questions, etc. So I do want to say how fabulous she is. And so if somebody wanted to access her, they would go to your website? Is that right?
They can do that, or they can contact her by email. Her email address is similar to mine with her first name, judith@endoflifechoicesny.org. I'm sorry, Judy. Not Judith. And
J-U-D-Y.
They can also reach her by phone.
Mm-hmm.
And the phone number to reach her at is 212-252-2015.
Mm-hmm. One more time.
212-252-2015.
Or Judy, J-U-D-Y, at endoflifechoicesny.org. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. So in the just a couple minutes we have left, so if your lawsuit is successful, do we not need the legislation? And if you do pass the legislation, is the lawsuit moot?
That's a very good question. If we win the lawsuit, that will establish the right that people have to access these medications. But there could potentially be legislation to provide some kinds of regulations and safeguards, which can be appropriate to an extent as long as they're not overly intrusive.
Mm-hmm.
If there's legislation that's enacted, the lawsuit might still continue in order to establish this as a constitutional right, because the next legislature could decide to rescind the legislation.
Mm.
So we don't think that the lawsuit would be moot simply because there had been legislation enacted. And by the way, I should say that both bills that are pending in the New York State Legislature do provide a lot of safeguards and to protect both patients, doctors, and family members.
And what is the name of the bill?
The bill that we have is called the Patient Self-Determination Act.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I mentioned sponsored by Assemblywoman Paulin and Senator Bonachick, and the numbers of those bills are A5261C and S5814A. And we, by the way, have a model letter on our website. If anyone wants to support the legislation, they can write their legislators with a form letter, which by just going to our website.
Great. And one more time, that website?
www.endoflifechoicesny.org.
Great. Well, David Levin, I want to thank you so much for coming on to HealthCetera again. This is really important work. I care about it deeply, and I hope that you're successful very soon, whether it's the lawsuit, the legislation, or both. So I encourage our listeners to go to that website, endoflifechoicesny.org, and learn more about this issue and lend your support as well. Thank you so much, David, for coming back on HealthCetera.
Thank you very much for having me, Diana.
So I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at our blog, HealthCetera, at www.healthmediapolicy.org. That's healthmediapolicy.org. You're listening to HealthCetera at WBAI 99.5 FM New York and streaming at WBAI.org. Thanks for listening.